everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a special program on the U.S. involvement in the recent crisis and changes in the Middle East, the Iraq debacle, and the new Islamic Caliphate. My guest today from Quebec will be Professor Mahdi Darius Nazim Roza. He is an award-winning author, scholar, geopolitical analyst specializing in the Middle East and Central Asia. He is a research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal. He is a contributor to the Strategic Cultural Foundation in Moscow and Voltaire Net, and is a member of the Scientific Committee of Geopolitica in Italy. During the Arab Spring, Mahdi reported from North Africa, particularly in Libya, during the NATO bombing, providing dispatches to Global Research and Pacifica's program Flashpoint. More recently, his focus has been on the upheavals in Syria and Iraq and the role of the U.S. in the Middle East and its instability. He is the author of The Globalization of NATO, which has been hailed by multilateral leaders and foreign government ministers as a divorce on expansion of NATO and its threat to peace and global security. I wanted to do this program on the recent upheavals unfolding in Iraq and the complete shifting of foreign policies and allegiances and the U.S. role and intentions in its meddling in the region, because it is increasingly becoming more and more confusing to the greater audience. There are numerous facets and players involved. Now we've been hearing about a call for a new Islamic caliphate among the jihadist organization, previously known as ISIS, and now the Islamic State, that has been operating in Syria and now in Iraq. For most of our listeners, they will be unaware of the power of the term caliphate in the collective consciousness of Muslims in the Middle East. It is a symbol that has deep meaning with the past and which is now being used as an invocation to bring greater unity among Muslims throughout the Arab nations. So I think we should begin with you sharing a history behind the term caliphate. What was the original caliphate, and why is this form of political governance so important to some Muslims today? And then share your views on how this new caliphate, preached by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, is different or even a perversion of past caliphates when there was greater unity among Arabs. The question is whether this is an Islamic caliphate or something completely different. And then finally, explain the role of a supreme religious leader in the caliphate form of governance, because we're now hearing Islamic groups, even from groups associated with Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra, denouncing this call for Islamic unity. Take your time, please. Our understanding is always based upon context, and the historical context will help us. The forum is yours.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be on your show. I'd like to point out that the caliphate in Arabic is called the Khalifa. The head of the caliphate is called a caliph, and the caliph is supposed to be the head of state and the spiritual head of that state. The caliphate is supposed to be a polity or state that represents the entire Muslim population, or all the faithful basically, or what in Arabic is called the Ummah. And that means all the Muslims. Basically, the Ummah is the word for community. And that's what the caliphate is supposed to represent. Now, there's two trends or main beliefs on who should be caliph or the head of this state. One of them is that person should be elected by the Ummah or Muslim community. All the Muslims have to elect the head of state and the head of their leader. And the other one is that there's a divine role involved, that basically God somehow picks who should be caliph, and that view is mostly held by the people who consider themselves Shia or Shiite Muslims. the Sunnis, or people who call themselves Sunnah, that word comes from the Arabic word for tradition, believe that it should be that person should be elected. But there are also Shiites who believe that person should be elected. The Shiites, though, however, they tend to look emphasize more on people who are descended from the Prophet Muhammad. They call these people the family of or the house of Muhammad, and that's the word for his Ahl al-Bayt. And those are the two main streams or currents on who should be caliph. Now, the history of the caliphate, we can say, starts with something called Dola Islamiyah, al-Islamiyah, the Islamic state. But this is not, it's not the same as the current one in Iraq. So the Islamic state in Iraq is not the same as the one that I'm talking about, which started in the time of the Prophet Muhammad in the Arabian Peninsula around the cities of Mecca and Medina. There are certain rules. There are certain procedures, certain traditions, certain precedents, and certain religious or Islamic guidelines that are supposed to be followed when establishing these states. If we look at the history of how this Islamic state was created, this state, it's better to call it a state for Muslims, was created. It was created with minimal bloodshed, and in fact, when Muhammad took over, he did it after the non-Muslims broke their treaty obligations with the Muslims. So the Muslims, by the way, were not at the beginning were very weak, and they were being persecuted. But they set up a treaty with the non-Muslims, what you would call the adulterers or the idolaters, the worshippers of idols. They basically broke their treaty obligations. They started killing and persecuting Muslims after there was an agreement by both sides. And that's when the Muslims basically took over. And when they did take over, they didn't execute anybody, including the people who had been murdering Muslims. They didn't go for any revenge killings. They actually opted to forgive. Forgiveness was the high route, and it was the better route. And that's how the first Dola Islamiyah, or state for Muslims, was established in the Arabian Peninsula. After Muhammad died, that's when basically we see the shell, we see the caliphate comes into use, the word caliphate comes into appearance. After he died, there was arguments. Well, there was a succession. Later, the arguments come in, a succession. And the term caliphate eventually started to be used to describe the people who succeeded Muhammad. The word khalifa is the Arabic word for succession. Okay, so that's where it comes from. I'll say it once again. The word caliphah is the Arabic word meaning succession. So these are the people who succeed Muhammad, are supposed to succeed Muhammad. And the way they've governed or did things, especially the initial ones who were called the Sahaba, those were Muhammad's companions, they didn't go around executing people. I think it's really important to point out that Christians or Jews lived amongst Muslims in a Muslim state. They weren't persecuted. They had special rights in regards to certain practices they could do that Muslims couldn't. There was a special tax on them, however, because they didn't need to, for example, be in the armed forces. They weren't obligated to go fight if there was a war. So because they didn't have these obligations, there was a special tax on them. But this is nothing like what we're seeing now with these groups that are calling themselves the successors, like the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, ISIL, or Daesh in Arabic, which is run by this man called al-Baghdadi. His name basically means Baghdadi, means he comes from Baghdad, who's declared himself caliph. Now, I started off explaining what the caliphate is by saying that there's two traditions. One is you get elected, and the other one you're selected. You're essentially from the family of the Prophet. You're an imam, basically, as the Iranians would say, and others. But this man is neither one. He's neither one, and he doesn't represent the entire Muslim body at all. And most Muslims don't take this call for a caliphate seriously by this man, because he has no credentials to be the leader of all Muslims. I mean, the people who take it more seriously are the non-Muslims. Now, that being said, the word caliphate is very important for many practicing Muslims, and it strikes a historic chord and memories of a golden era. Now, when the caliphates existed, before they were eroded, this was an era where Muslims were one of the only people, for example, that believed women had souls, you know. While the caliphate existed after Muhammad, I mean, in Europe, they were arguing whether women had souls. The church was arguing that. Or there was, in other parts of Africa, baby girls would be buried, you know. And the caliphate changed a lot of this. It was a golden age of science for the Muslims. And this wasn't just Arabs. It was a very pluralistic society. It included eventually Turkic people, various people from Hamitic peoples, from Eastern Africa, eventually the Iranians and the Afghans, as well as people in the Caucasus would be incorporated. And during this period of the caliphate, after Muhammad's death, after the successions, a lot of people in the area from Southwest Asia to North Africa actually turned into Arabs. Not only was there conversions to Muslims, but a lot of people adopted this Arabic identity, which originally comes from the Arabian Peninsula. So you have people in Lebanon and Syria who are basically Semitic peoples. You know, some of them are Hebrew-speaking, others are Aramaic-speaking, that's the language of Jesus. A lot of them actually started adopting Arabic, as well as Greek peoples who started adopting Arabic and considering themselves Arab. The Egyptians used to be called the Copts. The word Coptic, which the Coptic Church is named after, used to be the old word for Egyptians. But then a lot of the Egyptians adopted the Arabic language, and they took on the Arabic identity, as well as becoming Muslims. And it's the same thing in the Maghrib, or the Maghrib in Arabic, which essentially means Morocco. But in English, it means much more than Morocco. It includes the area that includes Tunisia, Algeria. These people were Berbers, you know, and they ended up becoming Arabs as well. So under this golden era, we can see diffusion, we can see cultural exchange, algebra, mathematics. The first universities were set up. Spain eventually enters the caliphate in its later history. Spain, Portugal, the southern part of France, the Italian islands of Sicily, Sardinia, they eventually enter too, and a lot is brought into the caliphate. And through the caliphate, a lot of knowledge is brought into Europe. For example, the oldest universities in Europe are in Spain, and that's because they were set up by the Moors, the Muslim Moors. And the Renaissance, and before that, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, this actually sparked in Europe because the Arabs are the ones who were reading the texts of the ancient Greeks or the ancient Romans and translating them, and then they brought them back to Europe and the church, through the church, and there was good communications. There wasn't always tensions between Muslims and Christians like many people think. So this sparked rejuvenation in Europe for lost history, lost information from ancient times. There was trade with the Chinese, India. I mean, so the caliphate, historically and religiously, there's a lot of good things about it. But this is not the same caliphate as has been declared in Iraq and Syria. This caliphate is more of a, I think the best way to term it is a deviant project that the United States has helped nurture, the U.S. government has helped nurture. If we look at the history of ISIL, you're going to see that al-Baghdadi was freed by the U.S., and for some reason, he had a lot of money. He developed his organization. I mean, if you look at the period when the United States was occupying Iraq, a lot of weapons went disappearing. In fact, when General Petraeus was a general in Iraq, you know, huge arms shipments went disappearing that no one talks about. It went to these fellows. They've been training and being they've been nurtured and being trained in Jordan for a few years now. We can look at 2006. We can look at Fatah al-Islam. It was put together by U.S. allies such as the Hariri clan in Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Jordan. We can look at the record. Even the Washington Post admits it, that the United States was co-opting members of al-Qaeda or insurgents in Syria or rebels, whatever you'd like to call them, by paying them. And all this is part of the genealogy of what we're seeing now in Iraq. I mean, I don't think that we can call ISIL in Iraq the manifestation of a failure of U.S. policy because of the Anglo-American invasion in 2003. I think it's the actual manifestation of U.S. policy in the Middle East. I mean, the United States is talking about helping Iraq, but if you read the Iraqi media, if you see the viewpoint from Baghdad, they're saying that the United States is doing very little to help us. And it seems like they're deliberately stalling help because they want these groups to gain further ground. At the same time, the United States is using this insurgency in Iraq to pressure the government of Nouri al-Maliki, which is the federal government in Iraq. I'd like to point out Iraq is a federal body, a federal polity, and the government of al-Maliki is a federal government there, and they're using this insurgency to pressure him to step aside. And why would they want to pressure this man who they actually basically helped get elected or helped come into power? It's because since Maliki was elected, and first of all, he wasn't the first choice of the United States. The United States wanted Alawi, who was basically, some people call mini Saddam. He worked with Saddam. He's tied to the CIA, a CIA asset. They wanted him. They wanted corrupt people like Ahmed Chalabi, who went to school, I believe, with Paul Wolfowitz, who's a fraudster, who's wanted for financial fraud in neighboring Jordan. They wanted these guys to take over Iraq, but they didn't. Maliki from the Doha Party took over and became prime minister in a democratic elections. The United States was not popular with the was not happy with the last elections in Iraq, which were the parliamentary elections in April, and they didn't want Maliki in charge. And why is that? Number one, Maliki and the Iraqi federal government have refused to help the United States against Bashar al-Assad's government in Syria. So Iraq has stayed out of it. It hasn't been part of the siege. If you look at its record through bilateral ties with Syria, or if you look at its record at the United Nations, how it's voted, or at the Arab League, and I'd like to mention, since I'm talking about the Arab League, it's a totally bankrupt body. It's totally corrupt, and it's basically a rubber stamp body that the United States controls through these dictatorships like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Bahrain. So Iraq, if you look at its record at the Arab League, it hasn't voted against Syria, just like Algeria. It's refused to be part of this siege. On the other hand, we can clearly see that the Iraqis are aligned to the Iranians. Iraq is aligned to Iran, and that's not because of sectarianism. It's not because Iran is a majority Shia Muslim country or that Iraq is a majority Shia Muslim country. About 65 to 70% of Iraqis are Shiites, but that's not the reason why they're aligned. We can see that Iraq's aligned to Iran for political reasons, Of course, the shared religious backgrounds and being neighbors and a shared history have helped with the political and economic mechanisms between the two. But we can see Iraq is aligned to Iran. Not only that, Iraq is buying weapons now from the Russian Federation. If we start looking the last few years, it's opted to start buying weapons from Moscow, you know, and this is a game changer in a way. It's been slow steps, but it shows that it's not just dependent on the United States. And Maliki hasn't, the Iraqi government, although it has many corrupt people, and it does have people who basically cater to U.S. interests, it hasn't given the big oil multinationals everything they wanted. And my last point is, well, the Iraqis are selling oil to the Chinese, and the United States wants to have a government in charge in Iraq, in Baghdad, that will basically be a proxy, a total vassal, that will cut shipments of oil to China whenever the U.S. asks, that it'll distance itself from Iran, and it'll help it in the siege against Syria and stop buying weapons from Russia. And this is one of the reasons that the United States has been inactive in supporting Iraq. There's been very token support. There's been token support. Weapon shipments have not really gone in. There's some advisor. I don't know what those advisors on the ground are doing, but there hasn't been the deliveries that have been asked for or paid for in advance. Those haven't been sent there. And in fact, we know very well now from what's being said in the U.S. Congress and by U.S. officials that the U.S. is pressing Maliki to step down, as well as for the government to be changed in Baghdad. This is basically regime change. So it's using ISIL for regime change. So while this insurgency is putting pressure on the government in Iraq, which is not perfect, and I'm not a fan of Nouri al-Maliki, but while ISIL is putting pressure on the government in Baghdad and declaring a so-called caliphate, the U.S. is also putting pressure. It has its own political objectives here. And I think that these are very important points that should not be lost by audiences when they hear about this declaration of a caliphate. Now, on the other hand, this declaration of a caliphate was made at the start of Ramadan. This is the Muslim month. This is the month of Ramadan in the lunar calendar that the Muslims use. It's a holy month of fasting. But this declaration of a caliphate was deliberately made at the start of Ramadan by al-Baghdadi. The reasons behind it are basically, it was PR. Very clearly, it was part of public relations. But the other points here that should not be lost is this caliphate is very sectarian. It's a caliphate that's not for all Muslims. It's specifically been said to be for Sunni Muslims. I don't agree with that because I think despite what they say, they only cater to very narrow-minded people's views. And this caliphate has been put into place or announced to basically create divisions in Iraq and Syria as well as the broader Middle East. I think that the goals of creating this caliphate are to basically ignite a Muslim civil war and to ignite a process of to increase and intensify a process of constructive chaos in the Middle East, which will turn into a sectarian war where Muslims will fight each other. So you'll have Shiite Muslims fighting Sunni Muslims. And on top of that, you'll have ethnic cleavages where ethnic groups will fight each other. So you have Kurds fighting Arabs or Turks fighting Kurds and Arabs. And I think this is what this caliphate in the heart of the Middle East is intended on doing.
I appreciate that extensive, nearly half-hour overview. I just have one more question at this time, and that begins with a observation. Since when do we have anyone in the United States, or for that matter, anywhere on the planet, who can determine that by giving training and arms and intelligence information to a radicalized jihadist, that you can then sparse your word by saying, well, this is a moderate jihadist. I don't believe that there is such a thing as a moderate jihadist. I think it's an oxymoron. the people who have been in intelligence for a long time, including Ray McGovern and others that we've spoken to, said it's absurd. We have been funding, arming, training radicalized groups for a long time, including in not just in parts of Syria, but also in other countries, including Jordan. And now we're getting the blowback, and we also benefit when there's chaos. And we would think, well, why? What would be the motive? Well, understand war is very profitable, and the armaments industry is the one industry that profits most. Then go to Washington, D.C. I've been on the air in Washington, D.C. for 31 years on our sister station, WPFW. And every time I do a lecture, last time it was at a big civic center there, it was packed, wall to wall. People came over later and said, you know, Gary, I listen every day at 3 o'clock. And you're right when you talk about the lack of ethics, morality, and a heart in the bureaucracies here. More often than not, the person who is trying to get ahead is using their contacts to solidify deals that they can make on behalf of themselves and their legislators, get money, then go into a private contracting, and the biggest contracting to go into is either Wall Street contracting or the pharmaceutical contracting, one of the big multinationals, and the war machine is the dominant machine. So one day you end up seeing that we have another Homeland Security offshoot. We have 10 people, 10 groups, 10 private corporations, often doing the same identical work. There's no oversight. There's no accountability. And yet we don't look at how all that is connected tangentially, not just existentially, to what's happening in the Middle East. So you're looking for reason. You're looking for common sense. You're looking for motive. And we fail to understand that just the power of money, the power of influence itself, can be all that's necessary to determine an outcome. Then you look at the neocons. You look at Wolfowitz and Richard Perle. You look at John Bolton. You look at Oliver North. Look at Sean Hannity. Look at Hillary Clinton. Look at all the people that were so convinced that we needed to be in Iraq. There were weapons of mass destruction. These are the same people now lecturing us about what we should do now. And I'm thinking, gee whiz, this whole thing started with under 1,000 people taking areas frequently without firing a shot in some areas because they were in support of Sunni areas that have been completely neglected by the government of Maliki, who is extremely corrupt. The man doesn't have an honest bone in his body. And yet he's the one and his administration that have excluded. They've excluded the large proportion of people who wanted some form of autonomy and independence and financial sustainability, the Kurds. They completely left the, much like the Tutsis did in Uganda, the Shiite, the dominant group, have left the Sunnis at the curb. And then we wonder why there is this sectarian violence. Well, when you've got an army maybe of 7,000 all over the Middle East against an army that is supported by Iran, that is supported by Hezbollah, that is supported by at least those who are capable of fighting in Iraq, and now they're going to go into tough areas, that's not going to be a cakewalk. And especially with drones and special abilities of special forces to nail them. And yet who benefits from this? And you hear every one of them every night on the pathetic excuse of a station called Fox Network, where I don't know what kind of litmus test they hold for journalists being able to just tell the truth. They keep bringing back Dick Cheney as if he is a sage of wisdom. This man is culpable and complicit up to his eyeballs and saying, what is the outcome? Well, the outcome is going to be once they establish their caliphate, then they're going to put their eyes on Europe and the United States. They're coming after us. Suddenly you hit the trigger mechanism that causes fear and panic, and then you get people to overreact or listen to people who have once again, just like in the Vietnam War, the domino of that factor, once again in Grenada, we got to go in there. Once again in Panama, we got to go in there. Once again in the Balkans, we got to go in there. Once again in Afghanistan, once again in Iraq. The same group of individuals, the same theme, the same ideology, the same media complicity, with Judith Miller at the New York Times and others banging the drums, and you pull back and say, hold on a second. You've been wrong on every single thing you've said. You haven't uttered an honest word in 40 years. Why in the world should we trust you at this moment? You're a pathologically disturbed individual, all of you. You're sociopaths. look at the consequences. We come back in body bags or dismembered and plead for people to give donations to get someone a prosthetic leg or wheelchair, and you just made another $100 million. Why can't we look at the truth of any of our actions? Your final thought, my observation, do you believe that that is in any way connected to what is happening? Power, greed, self-interest, having nothing in the world to do with the legitimate challenges or illegitimate challenges of those seeking power in that area of the world.
Well, greed is definitely involved here. We can't isolate economic objectives from what's happening there. I mean, ethnic cleavages, sectarian cleavages, they all disguise what essentially, at the end of the day, is economic. They're all intersected by economic issues. That we can't overlook that, of course. At the end of the day, like you said, military contractors, oil interests, these are all there. And in fact, Mosul and Kirkuk, which have been taken over, and it's not clear exactly who's taken over, because I'd like to remind listeners that it's not just ISIL that's there. There are people with legitimate grievances against the government. The oil there now is going to be illegally shipped to Turkey, all right? So this group, ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq, and the Levant, which has recently renamed itself as the Islamic State, was stealing oil in Syria, and it was being sold through Turkey on international markets. And if the United States was interested in stopping terrorism, it would have stopped the sale of that oil through Turkey. This group has assets of somewhere between $2 to $3 billion, and the precedent was set in places like Libya, where, for example, Qatar was mandated by the U.S. and NATO to sell oil that the rebels were basically commandeering in eastern Libya, in Cyrenaica, around Benghazi, and they're doing the same thing right now in Iraq. So you have oil that's going from Kirkuk illegally through northern Iraq into Turkey, and there's already been various deals made for it. ISIL is not the only one selling it. But if the United States is genuinely interested in stopping terrorism, they would, for example, stop the sale of this oil on international markets. So once again, I emphasize that this group, ISIL, has $2 to $3 billion in its pockets. It's also tied to organized crime. I think that it's very important that we remember that Muslims essentially are one group, that the differences between Sunnis and Shiites is very, there are very few differences. It's very nuanced. It's not as great as it's being pushed. This is mostly political. The conflicts between them is based on politics and allegiances to parties. It's not based on any inherent religious difference. And I think that's very important to emphasize. But the economic question, I absolutely agree with you. I think that it's also important to point out that when Maliki came into power, he was called the man in the middle. And the reason he's called the man in the middle by many newspapers throughout the press was because he had to balance the interests of Iran and he had to balance the interests of the United States. Essentially, the political establishment in Iraq was allied to both Iran and the United States. A lot of these Shiite groups, even Kurdish groups, were allied to both Iran and the United States. So they had to play a balancing act between both. I mean, that's also something we can't forget. And yes, there have been people that have been disenfranchised. Some of them are Sunni, but some of them are also Shiite. It's not the Sunnis alone. And this is something we should also keep in mind.
I appreciate those insights. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Mahdi, I have an issue that has not been discussed in the mainstream media, and that is that there were comments in 2008 by Vice President Biden, who was then, of course, in the Senate, And he wanted to divide Iraq into three sectarian states, one for the Sunnis, one for the Shia, and another for the Kurds. Would you please go into this in more detail? And then I'd like to hear your assessment as to whether the events unfolding are following in what Washington had planned all along, or is just this coincidental to what he might have wanted?
Well, the Biden plan, which was presented to the United States Congress and the U.S. government, as well as lobbied in the Middle East and supported by Israel, I may add, wasn't just put forward by Joseph Biden, who's currently the vice president, but it was also it was a bipartisan initiative, which included Democrats and Republicans. And basically, he wanted the North divided into Kurdistan. He wanted the central region divided into a Sunni Iraq. And he wanted the South to be preserved for the Shiite Arabs. But this is something that is been longstanding U.S. policy. I mean, it's been talked about in think tanks, in universities, and by U.S. policymakers in conjunction with the Israelis who, since the 1980s and even prior, were talking about dividing countries like Iraq. So you have the Yunon plan, which also talks about dividing Iraq into three sectarian sections, one for the ethnic Kurds in the north, the center again for the Sunni Arabs, and the south for the Shiite Arabs. You have the Clean Break document, which was authored in 1996 for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu by people like Richard Perle and other U.S. officials, actually, some of them who actually ended up in the State Department and pushed for a war with Syria in 2003. The Clean Break document also talks about using Central Iraq, which essentially means the Sunni rump state, against Syria in this document, which calls for rolling back Syria as a mean of securing the realm, which is what they refer to as the Middle East, for Israel. So several members of that document, including Richard Perle, ended up being in the Bush 2 administration and in the Department of Defense. One of them ended up being Dick Cheney's personal advisor on the Middle East, and they pushed for a war in Syria. So in 2003, after Baghdad fell to U.S. tanks and troops, the U.S. government under the Bush 2 administration was actually contemplating attacking Syria. It called this Phase 3 of the global war on terror. Phase 1 was Afghanistan, Phase 2 was Iraq, and Phase 3 was Syria. So there is a long-standing tradition of talking about this. That's why you have maps being produced at the U.S. National War College, the Pentagon's different Pentagon programs, showing this map that was drawn for Ralph Peters, Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, who was formerly in Army Intelligence, drew a map called the New Middle East, which also shows Iraq divided again. This map was recreated in the Atlantic magazine in 2008 in an article by Jeffrey Goldberg, which talks about the Middle East after the invasion of Iraq. And in fact, Goldberg in the last few weeks has this map has popped up in the Atlantic again, and he said, let nature take its course. And that's actually the same line that Biden's been using. He's saying that this division is inevitable, that the sectarian hate is there, and the sooner we accept it, the better. So the Biden plan not only wanted Iraq divided into three, it formulated that this division take place through what I call soft Balkanization, in a more technical term for it is soft Balkanization. But in practical terms, the word for it is federalization. Now, federalization is not always a bad thing, but federalizing Iraq under this context of sectarian communities basically is eroding the state, and that's what started to take place. And even as recently as last year, the New York Times, even through the Wilsonian Institute, and I want to point out before I speak about the map that the New York Times published, that the Wilsonian Institute is continuing Woodrow Wilson's tradition of dividing areas in the name of independence and freedom, of course, but which started in Eastern Europe, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, for example, which ended up having the United States recognize Czechoslovakia as a state before the Czechoslovaks even declared their own independence. Anyways, this Wilsonian Institute produced a map through the New York Times of the Middle East divided again. So you saw Libya divided into three, and actually that has taken place. So Libya is divided basically in practice into three: Cyrenaica in the east, Fezzan in the south, and Tripolitania to the northwest near Tunisia and Algeria. The map also showed Yemen divided, and right now there is a secessionist movement in Yemen to divide it into two again, and it showed Syria and Iraq divided. So this, regardless of it being coincidence or not, it is something that is wanted. It is an objective. That can't be denied, because you have people in government, you have people in think tanks, universities, and military apparatus talking about dividing these places. And I remember very clearly before the war in Libya, before NATO attacked, the head of the U.S. Intelligence was talking about this to the Senate. He was saying we're probably going to see the country go back to its three autonomous or divisional entities that existed, so Cyrenaica, Fezzan, and Tripolitania after the war. So this has been something that's been pushed, and we have to remember that when the United States and Britain illegally invaded and occupied Iraq in 2003, one of the first things they did is dissolve the National Armed Forces and the security and police apparatus. What that did is weaken the state, because those institutions were holding things together. Not only that, anything that was tied to a unified identity in Iraq was destroyed as well. So you had historical sites, archaeological sites, museums, anything that was of national value towards a national identity was attacked. It was attacked. And there's even been cases of, for example, the British SAS in Basra were dressed like locals, and they were attacking a mosque. So when the United States and Britain went into Iraq, that's when the sectarianism started. You started seeing Shiite mosques being attacked and Sunni mosques being attacked. And this did not exist prior to this. People's sects were a matter of personal knowledge. People didn't go around saying I'm a Shiite or Sunni. Of course, there was incidents, and those cleavages have always existed, just like how in Canada, where I am, there's cleavages between French Canadians and English Canadians, Anglophones and Francophones. Those cleavages are there, but they were magnified and fueled and used nefariously when the United States went into Iraq. So I am of the opinion of that this is something that they've wanted in Iraq. And if you look right now, well, the Kurds are saying we're going to declare our own state. They've used the opportunity, and they're being supported by Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu came out saying we support this. The Turks, who are a U.S. and Israeli ally, are also tacitly supporting this, and they've already made business deals for Kurdistan regional government to send Iraqi gas illegally, oil into Turkey, which can also be shipped to places like Israel. And Israel is actually buying some of this natural gas. So these American allies are supporting this. And this caliphate, which actually was predicted by the U.S. government, if you look at I believe it's last year, one of the intelligence estimates, not intelligence estimates, one of the reports on the forecast of the world talks about the resurrection of a caliphate, you know, and it talks about this caliphate coming, possibly not being strong at all, but this caliphate is essentially dividing Iraq into three, because the federal government is going to end up running just the south, which is Shiite, and we are seeing that Iraq is being divided. Regardless of people thinking it's coincidence or not, they have to accept that there is an objective to divide Iraq, or at least in think tanks and by policymakers, and that it is happening. So, I mean, the proof is in the pudding.
It's been said that Israel's Middle East foreign policy wants to see a completely fragmented Arab and Persian world, with small individual nations without any military economic strength in the region, in order for Israel to be the top position. What do you observe at this mission being played out by the United States and Israel and the creation of the Islamic State and the breakup of Iraq and Syria?
Well, this tradition is a long-standing tradition. It starts prior to Israel. I mean, Sykes-Picot is the model example of this division. And prior to Sykes-Picot, which was an agreement between a secret agreement between the British and the French, the only reason we know about it is because the Russian Tsarist government, the imperial government in St. Petersburg, knew about it. But once the Bolshevik Revolution happened, the Soviets let it be known that this agreement was made. Before Sykes-Picot, you had the British pursuing a divide-and-conquer policy as well in Europe. The British motto was, the maxim was, divide the continental. The continental meant the Europeans. It meant keep Germany divided. It meant keep the French and Germans from aligning, keep the Russians and Germans from aligning. So this policy has been inherited by the United States and later Israel, which is the youngest of the three. So you can see before after Sykes-Picot that Arab countries have constantly been fractured, not just by Israel, but by the British, the French, and of course the United States. Egypt and Sudan used to be one country. You know, Gamal Abdel Nasser never forgave the British for dividing Egypt and Sudan. The British illegally occupied Sudan when it was a part of Egypt, and they referred to it as Anglo-Egyptian Sudan. But it was actually one state, and they helped divide it, and they pushed for sectarianism in Sudan, where they made a lot of Sudanese feel that, oh, the people in Cairo, those Egyptians, are different from us, and they're taking advantage of us. And, of course, we've seen that in South Sudan being played. Tunisia was broken from Algeria. Kuwait was divided from Iraq. The French divided Lebanon from Syria and imposed a heavy sectarian system there, where they divided the Orthodox Christians from the Protestant Christians, which were a minority, from the Orthodox Christians and from the Druze and the Shiite and Sunni Muslims. You see Jordan and Palestine being broken from one another. Palestine and Jordan and Syria and Lebanon were actually all one state. In the Levant, it was called Greater Syria, essentially. One cultural state. In Arabic, it's called Bilad al-Sham, and the land of Sham, which means Syria. And that name comes from Damascus. Damascus is also called Sham. So they divided these places. And yes, the Israelis have inherited this strategy of dividing the region, because this is one way they can protect their hegemony, but they're not the only ones. I mean, it is a long-standing tradition, and the United States government also believes in this view. I'd like to talk about National Security Advisor Brzezinski. Well, he came from Poland. He studied actually in Montreal, McGill University, before he immigrated to the United States or became a U.S. citizen. He inherited this intellectual tradition called Prometheism. Prometheism was developed in Poland, and it talked about breaking up the Russian Empire. That's why you also see that it's not only the Middle East that's being broken up. Eastern Europe is, the Soviet Union, before that, the Tsarist Empire in Russia. They've all been consecutively broken. And, you know, Brzezinski himself says that in the end, Russia should be divided into three sectors, a European Russia, a Siberian Russia, and a Far Eastern Russia. So it's not just Israel that wants to divide these places to become stronger. The U.S. also wants to see the broader landmass of Eurasia divided up, and that's why it supports divisions and sectarianism in the Middle East in convergence with Israel.
My final question is, the new Cold War that Washington and its European allies are waging against Putin and Russia, now with Russia coming to the aid of Syria and Maliki's Iraq government, and the close relations between Russia and China, how are these new alliances by these global powers challenging the Washington doctrine in the Middle East affairs?
Well, I don't think personally it's a matter of categorization that the Cold War really ever ended. I think it's a new phase of the Cold War, because the U.S. was, even communism was or socialism were a pretext for geopolitical aggression or conquest or rivalries. And I think that it's important to realize that United States wanted what some people call the New World Order, but I think in more daily use, maybe in the universities, the term for it is unipolar world after the Cold War. And this objective of creating a unipolar world where the United States' domestic laws are superior to international law, for example, or U.S. foreign policy trumps all else, this pushed the People's Republic of China and the post-Soviet Russian Federation together, especially after the United States started bombing the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. And I'd like to mention, when it was bombing the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia in 1999, it also bombed the Chinese embassy, and very deliberately so, with supposedly high-precision missiles. I mean, this pushed the Russians and Chinese together. Actually, there was a historic meeting between Boris Yeltsin just before the eve of him retiring and Putin taking over with the leaders of with China's president. And they declared that we will stand in the way of the United States' drive for a unipolar world. And a strategic agreement was made between the two. And since then, the Sino-Russian partnership has been growing and strengthening. And they realize that the Middle East is very central to U.S. strategy in this area, Eurasia, and this Cold War. If the United States dominates the Middle East, and that includes Iran, Iraq, Syria. Well, that'll create huge problems for the Russian and Chinese. First of all, the Iranians are heavily tied to the people in the Caucasus and to Central Asia. They are culturally, linguistically, ethnically, religiously, economically, and politically tied to these areas. They're tied to Georgia. They're tied to Armenia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan. Persian's even the official language in Tajikistan, and it's one of the two spoken languages in Uzbekistan, as well as a minority language in Azerbaijan. There's more Azerbaijanis in Iran than there are in the Republic of Azerbaijan. So these connections are very close. If the Iranians change orbit, let's say, what will happen is the gateways to the Caspian and the Caucasus in Central Asia will be opened, and the United States can use it to heavily change the orbit of that area vis-a-vis the Iranians. And this would be a threat to the Chinese and the Russians, not only for security reasons, but also because of the energy that reserves that are there. The energy in the Middle East also, the Chinese have a problem. Well, they have a shortage of energy. They have a thirst for their growing industries to have energy resources. And the United States wants a chokehold around China. That's why the U.S. Navy is built up around the route in the Indian Ocean around China. That's why the Chinese have counteracted this by setting up bases in places like Sri Lanka, Pakistan, to secure the energy route, because they know if tensions are very geared up between them and the United States, or possibly if there's possibly a war scenario in the future, that the United States will, first thing it'll try to do is cut any energy shipments to China. So this is one of the reasons the Middle East is important to the United States in this Cold War. The other thing I'd like to mention is, since 1945, since the post-World War II period, the United States has seen the Middle East central to its Eurasia strategy. And this Eurasia strategy is not modern. That's why you have people like the Dutch American academic who came up with the term Rimland. He comes with a term called Rimland, which talks about encircling Russia and China. And in that context, they refer to the Middle East as the central zone. And that is why the United States calls its geographic military command in the Middle East United States Central Command. Not only that, the United States actually set up a sister organization to NATO in the Middle East, which is now defunct. It was called the Middle East Treaty Organization, or commonly the Baghdad Pact. But after Iraq left, because there was a revolution and it became pro-Soviet, the Baghdad Pact was called the Central Treaty Organization, while there was the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in Europe, and also the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization in Southeast Asia. This was encircling China and Russia, and these alliances are in the area that the U.S. strategists call the Rimland, and they were all dominated by the United States. The U.S. was an associate member in CENTO, or the Central Treaty Organization. It was part of the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, along with countries like France, Britain, Thailand, Australia, and in the Middle East, Turkey was also included in both NATO and CENTO, as well as Britain being included in both. So you can see there's encirclement is definitely part of this picture, and the Middle East is key to that encirclement.
Well, my final thought on this is simple. Just as a child could look at a problem, and if the child was not presented with an ideology they had to honor, they'd say, look at what we were told with absolute certainty by the President, Secretary of State, the head of the Defense Department, Rumsfeld, and Clayton, General Powell, President of the United States, Condoleezza Rice, head of the CIA, George Tenet. They all said with certainty there were weapons of mass destruction, yet we now know that that was gained information, along with Tony Blair. They all knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. They were working against their own CIA analyst. They were working against their own national defense group, because they had an agenda. Now we know that. They should have been held accountable, and in a really country that believes in the rule of law, they would be held accountable for crimes against humanity. Look at what happened. 5 million Iraqis made homeless in a country of only about 38 million at the time. We used depleted uranium, destroyed their environment forever. The highest incidence of birth defects and rare cancers in the world are occurring in Iraq. We are seeing now over 1 million Iraqi civilians killed. We saw where they did have an imbalance in power, with the Sunnis representing the majority of those positions in power, and the Sunnis, the Shia representing the minority in power, even though they're the majority. At least there was what represented a relatively progressive public health system, one of the best in the Middle East. Yes, Saddam Hussein was a tyrant, but almost every country in the Middle East is run by either a tyrant or a military junta with a Saudi family. And yet we chose the tyrants and the despotic regimes who were in our favor and those that we were opposed to, which is absolutely schizophrenic. At the end of this, we've destroyed a country. We allowed them everything they need to slaughter each other. We created incredible divisiveness. All the while, the only reason that this did not escalate further was because the one powerful man who, in my opinion, will be the most powerful person in Iraq in the next several years, Mukhtar Sadr, went to Iran to get his formal formal religious indoctrination to come back to be the one of the top people within the religious community, the Shia religious community. He has 100,000 people in his control who are armed and fighters. Now you have total corruption. We've corrupted the whole system. We caused 4,600 American dead, over 45,000 injured, over 1 million sick and suffering. 23 vets kill themselves each day. We have spent at least $3 trillion, with Joseph Stiglitz figuring it will be another $3 trillion or $6 trillion by the time we take care of all the people that we've taken care of, will be taken care of. And that's without taking care of anyone or any rebuilding of infrastructure in Iraq itself. We then allow Israel to dominate our policy, and we wonder why there's such a crisis. And now we're looking at none of the context, historical, ideological, political, that put all this into play. And so all we're looking at is another group of people that we feel are committing themselves to creating fear in the American public, so we have to overreact to it. I just think it's absolutely mind-numbingly foolish. I want to thank you for your input, your scholarship, and sharing your insights. The book is The Globalization of NATO. The website is globalresearch.ca and voltairenet.org. Thank you very much, Mahdi, for being with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Professor Mahdi Darius Nazimirzaev, I'm Gary Nall. Look forward to sharing more on our next Progressive Commentary Hour.